Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. It's been quite a while that I recorded something, but I've been thinking about this one a lot. I guess just other things come in between, as they tend to do. And this session is going to be on ambiguity and rules. And I wasn't super creative with the title. I just called it Against Rules. I think that's all anybody needs to know about this one in order to kind of get an idea of what this session will be about. So I just want to start with some feedback. I wrote a little article on punctuation, and that was for an online platform, and I had quite a lot of response, which was really beautiful to have a conversation with people from the US and from Australia about punctuation, and I felt quite enriched. They sent me lots of different ideas and impressions and so on, and there was one Eric from New York, that's all I know about him, who sent me an excerpt from the Associated Press style book, Another Entry Punctuation. They say, so they before they say what the colon, comma, dash and so on is, they say that, quote, punctuation should not be treated casually. The quotation continues. Think of punctuation as a courtesy to your readers designed to help them understand the story. Think of punctuation as a courtesy to your readers designed to help them understand a story. So this was the quotation, and Eric asks, is understanding not the primary objective of communication? Which I thought was wildly interesting. There's so much to do, so much to unpick and think about. And I want to take that question and see what happens to punctuation if we look at it from this perspective, that understanding is the first and foremost purpose of communication and punctuation is sort of a helpmeet for that. Or what I also want to do, or perhaps end what I also want to do, is to have a look at the question itself and see what happens to it if we look at it from a punctuation perspective. So I will be talking about rules and I will be talking about ambiguity, but this introduction continues. Just bear with me for another little while. There are plenty of examples concerning, you know, funny examples, joking examples, examples in literature and drama, Shakespeare's full of it, where somebody makes mistakes of punctuation or uses punctuation in an ambiguous way to remain ambiguous, or to become the butt of fun. So there's a moment in Midsummer Night's Dream where who are called mechanics, where there's a play in a play and they just completely bungle up the punctuation and it becomes very funny and characters mock them and so on. And then there's also a moment in, I think it's Richard II, where somebody quotes a Latin, or somebody writes in Latin, I'm sure it's a quotation from some classical literature. And it's a messenger, so that's on a written piece of paper. And it says, something or other, I should have looked this up, nolite timere occidere rex bonum est. And that can mean, without punctuation, it means either, it is good not to, do not fear, it is good to kill the king, or it is good to fear, do not kill the king, which obviously is just the absolute opposite. But because the language is case-based and you can just put the words almost anywhere, there is that window of ambiguity. And the people who sent that message to the ultimate killer of Richard II, the king, they made use of that because afterwards they sort of threw up their hands in the air and said, well, this is not what we meant. You basically punctuated in the wrong way, in the way that you wanted it to be. So there's plenty of examples like that, although people like David Crystal, for example, the linguist, they suggest that those examples of we're really not encountering those examples in our everyday. I mean, 99.99999% we won't encounter these kinds of examples where there is an actual ambiguity Why we wouldn't be able to make sense of a sentence that doesn't have punctuation, so it becomes ambiguous from the context. But then, you know, you have books like Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots and Leaves that are based on this kind of punning, I guess. And I recently came across an Australian comedian. She's fantastic. And she's called Louisa Fitzharding. She says about herself, Louisa's found true love in the English language, but it's hard being a grammar nerd when there are people selling potatoes, you know, that's potato, apostrophe S, and misusing the word literally at every turn. All she really wants is someone who will snuggle up with her on the couch and seductively whisper puns into her ear, ideally in multiple languages. Is that too much to ask? I think that's too much to ask. Obviously, she's being funny, but few of us will be that sapiosexual, I hope. So there's a level of, I think, annoyance that goes both ways with punctuation or with grammar in general. People who call themselves sticklers and who patronize others, and then people who think those sticklers have, like... excuse me, but you know, stick up the backside on over punctuation, over things that are not actually that big of a deal. So that's why I just thought I want to think a little bit about rules and punctuation, because very often punctuation rules become an object of contention and also pain, for example, at school. So what I will be talking about in this episode, the difference of between rules and conventions, as far as I can see it at least, how rules in punctuation came about, because that's not exactly very obvious, and why we might need them or why we might not need them actually, and perhaps we should rethink things. And following on from that, what if we didn't need rules? Would we sink into chaos? Would we not understand what somebody else is saying or what we are saying upon rereading our own texts? And that leads me to think about and look at some examples of ambiguity and how punctuation can help us or create ambiguity, either by being there or by not being there. And then maybe, I guess I can say that now without any spoilers, I think I want to recuperate the notion of ambiguity in general and then the notion of ambiguity in relation to punctuation and that whole understanding as the objective of communication. Right. So rules. Rules have always existed. And before I think about rules, I want to think of rules as convention. I want to think about conventions and recommendations, because I think in the past, until really the 18th century, people were thinking about language and grammar, maybe even prescribing others how to do it or describing the state of affairs as they saw it or as they would have liked to see it. They were still quite flexible and they thought of these things rather as recommendations than rules. It's only really sort of in the 18th century that harsh understanding or approach of rules and language came in. And we're going to look at, you know, why that might be the case. But up until then, I think it was rather that people were writing, also in terms of spelling, for example, based on conventions. What are conventions? My understanding of convention is just that it's a bunch of practices that people do. That's super broad. And I realize that it's not just in writing. I mean, you know, we have other kinds of conventions, for example, to shake hands and not anymore after the pandemic, but we kind of acknowledge each other in one way or another, maybe physically. That's like a convention, right? There's no rule that says we should do that. We just kind of do it. And so also writing and punctuation as a phenomenon of writing have conventions. And that's just kind of stuff that we have tacitly agreed on doing and that we subscribe to. And these practices are quite fuzzy. They tend to be fuzzy, they change over time, they adapt to fashions, they adapt to tastes, and very much so to developing technologies. For example, I think I've probably talked about that before, but with instant texting, we tend not to use full stops anymore. So this the sort of a disappearance of the full stop if it's a fast exchange of messages. If it's a deeper kind of communication that has more characters and that has, you know, feelings and thoughts, and rather than just "Are you at the cinema?", that still tends to have punctuation. But because of that, technological medium, that change, and all the attendant mechanics, I suppose, of it, and our behavior towards it and with it, and what we do with it, and what it does with us. That changes what we do. That changes the convention. New conventions are being created. The ones that don't serve us anymore, we discard them over time, or quite quickly, actually. So I was thinking, for example, a convention that I don't think has been written down anywhere, either in printers' manuals from the past or in grammars, is that right up until the 19th century, in English, I don't think there was a rhyme and reason necessarily to which nouns, some nouns were capitalized. And I don't mean, you know, London or the Queen or something like that, but something like chair. And in the Renaissance, in the 16th and 17th century, people or printers would italicize first names, given names. So, for example, Cicero or like Tully or something, that would be italicized. But that was a convention. People just kind of did it. And then you would passively absorb that and become used to it as a reader. And then you would expect it and so on. And, you know, at some point that sort of stuff changes. And then there's a new convention that you don't do that anymore. So that's my understanding of convention. A bunch of stuff we do and kind of agree on, although we might not even really realize what it is that we're doing, but we sort of passively absorb it and we pass it on in our own textual productions, let's say. Now, what is a rule in relation to convention? I would say that a rule is a solidification of a convention. And in the past, writers and thinkers definitely sounded prescriptive. They grammarians sounded like they wanted people to tell what they should do and how they should do it. But I think actually, as I said, until sort of the 18th century, there was a high level of tolerance for the actual practice of reading and writing. And in the 18th century, I read one historian saying that in the 18th century only there was this notion of language as science that started to be established. And then, you know, we have philology, the practice of philology being established at universities in the 19th century. And then, you know, the hardcore science, language as science, linguistics in the early 20s and then very much in the 20th century. So kind of in the 18th century, that solidification starts, and you have a proliferation of grammar books. And, people were still kind of doing what they did, but there was also a certain amount of shame involved in not knowing what you did. I think I mentioned that in other podcasts before, but writers like Lord Byron, Charlotte Bronte, Wordsworth, they didn't know how to punctuate. They said, you know, Byron said, "I'm a sad hand at your punctuation. Can you please do this for me?" His editor, Coleridge, never knew. No, I think it was Wordsworth. Never knew the actual scientist that Coleridge recommended him to punctuate his poems. So because and people were sort of starting to feel self-conscious about it. However, you have grammarians in the 18th century who are very influential with their publications, and who list like rules after rules, or like comma rules and whatever, and, you know, giving examples and so on, and say, "Do this, do that, do this, do that." And then in the end, they admit that mostly it depends on fashion or taste and the author's discretion. And I found some really interesting examples that I want to read out some excerpts. So this is from Bishop Lowth's, or Louth's, I honestly don't know how to pronounce them, the bishop's grammar from 1762. So he gives lots of examples and rules for period, colon, comma, and so on. And then he says at the very end, the doctrine of punctuation must needs be very imperfect. Few precise rules can be given which will hold without exception in all cases. But much must be left to the judgment and taste of the writer. It remains, therefore, that we be content with the rules of punctuation laid down with as much exactness as the nature of the subject will admit, such as may serve for a general direction, to be accommodated to different occasions, and to be supplied where deficient by the writer's judgment. So there we are. We have all those rules, and then in the end we're like, well, actually, you know, you kind of can do what you want. And this stuff goes on. There's something here that I found, another thing that I found interesting. Somebody else, Robertson, Joseph Robertson, in an essay on punctuation, 1785, says, these rules, I must confess, are liable to some exceptions and are not sufficient to direct the learner in every imaginable combination of words and phrases. It would indeed be impossible to frame such a system of rules as should comprehend. So the question is, if punctuation keeps flouting rules or subverting them or making them and then somehow pulling them down, why do we have those rules in the first place? And why do we punish people for a misplaced comma or something like that? You know, I'd rather hear about someone's ideas with maybe iffy punctuation than to have like a perfectly punctuated, I mean, it doesn't exist, perfectly punctuated, correctly punctuated text that is just boring. So I feel like rules are some kind of star that orientates our movement or thinking or writing. But the actual expression is happening on the long and, you know, deliciously winding, wayfaring, explorative road, I would say. And the star is kind of where we want to go to, but it's not the road, right? What I find really fascinating now in our digital age are memes and, like, lolcats, and you know this meme with the cats, I has cheeseburgers and stuff, where we deliberately make mistakes. And that's also not a new thing, it's been around for thousands of years too. But so in these memes we make deliberate mistakes, and we know we make them, and you know everybody's laughing about them, but it doesn't mean that we go back to our letter to our boss or email to whoever, the landlord or something, and we make the same kinds of mistakes. We can make a difference between those contexts, and we know that this is that is a very bounded space that allows us to make those errors. Very much like carnival, you know, upside down world, people dressing up, or like going out at night and, you know, just behaving differently because it's the night, because it's party time now. You wouldn't behave like that during the day and whatever. People have a way of making difference between different contexts. And the same goes for writing and spelling and grammar and punctuation. In fact, there are studies that look at teenagers, or even I think between 12 and 15 year olds and their way of expressing themselves. And they have seen that teenagers that make those deliberate mistakes in their texting, and that are tend to be particularly creative, actually, or that are, you know, that are explorative with language, that make up new words, or that use punctuation a certain way, or something like that, in the social media or in the texting writing. If and if only that goes together with the usual standard school teaching of grammar and spelling and syntax and punctuation and all of those things. So if you have that, if you have that grounding, I don't think, I mean, I guess only now can there be studies coming out of, you know, true digital natives. I'm 33 and I remember when, you know, somebody brought a computer to school, like a huge Windows 95 monster. And we were like, what the hell is this? Not interesting. So I fundamentally don't think I am a digital native. But younger people will be, who are 15 now or 18 or something like that. So there are only now studies coming out that start to be able to look at the impact of the internet and of the digital communication and so on language proficiencies, for example. But that doesn't mean we need to be scared. We just need to make sure we have both at the same time. One is, you know, can't be turned back, and maybe we shouldn't, I don't know. And the other, it needs to stay. We need to defend that and make sure that we have that. Right, that was a little excursion. And exactly the thing that I think I want to make come across is, I think rather than teach rules that you need to be slavishly adhered to in terms of punctuation at school, that doesn't exist anyway, because punctuation is super slippery. It's not like a spelling of a word that even doesn't make sense, maybe the pronunciation, but that goes back to history or something. But punctuation mostly is really a lesson in humility, because there's hardly no moment where one can say this needs to be like that. So I think rather than take points off students and pupils at school and whatever for forgetting something or making a supposed mistake, it's better to teach and to explore and to play around with how can I use punctuation in a way that gets across my message in a more effective way, that creates a certain kind of tone, expressiveness, that is adapted to the context. Like, you probably wouldn't write an email with a lot of exclamation marks to your lawyer, but you can do that to your friend and then it will create a rapport and whatever. So that seems to me a more true and a more generous way to think about punctuation, especially in a teaching context. Now, people who like rules in general and language rules are very ready to mock others, and somehow they get a kick out of patronizing. But rules are pretty boring if you really follow them by the book. Whose book anyway? So what I want to do in the second part now is want to tweak the idea of understanding as primary objective of communication a little bit. And I want to suggest that perhaps we understand in a more full way if we don't understand it first. So if the thing that is being written, if the text makes us ask questions, that we keep asking questions, we keep being puzzled and unsure and nervous, and we sort of try to find direction out by indirection, that is something that I find interesting and more interesting. And I think that is ambiguity. When a text is ambiguous, when the punctuation is ambiguous, and just opens up this landscape of interpretation. So then that ambiguity becomes productive, and we can embrace it and enjoy it rather than exclude and try to eliminate all the time. Again, that's probably context specific. You don't want a doctor to be ambiguous in their writing, I don't think, but you know, literary writing or perhaps personal correspondence. It's true, though, that punctuation was first invented for clarity and against ambiguity, I would say. So remember, we have Aristophanes, I think, like 200 BC or so, preparing a text in order to be read by somebody who isn't familiar with Greek, or with that kind of Greek anyway, with the, you know, the Koine Greek, not classical Greek, but anyway, not familiar with the language. And not necessarily familiar with the rhythm of or style of a certain kind of text. Because imagine, you know, what do we say? Harry Potter is the only thing you're reading. you don't need necessarily punctuation for that. Like, if you just read Harry Potter, you sort of know it by heart, then you kind of don't need the punctuation. You're going to be able to make sense of it. So familiarity is a great factor in terms of the lack of punctuation. People thinking, well, it's not necessary because, you know, I know it anyway. But Aristophanes wanted to make Greek available for people who were not native speakers and also who wanted to pronounce it. So at first, yes, punctuation was introduced or invented for clarity and to help people. And secondly, punctuation, you know, is, there's nothing less at stake than your soul. And that is where Christianity comes in. From very early on, Christian church fathers were thinking about how can we make sure that official doctrine remains anchored in the text. So somebody, I mean, the text is being reproduced and people copy it and stuff. And then there was a lot of quarrel over the meaning of the text or the words. And so how, what can we do on the page to make sure that Bibles are being reproduced or ecclesiastical writing that is not heretic based on official declarations of the Pope and Church Fathers. What is it called? Like conventions, church, nah, I can't remember the word. Sorry. Anyway, Augustine, Saint Augustine, an early church father, gave an example where if you do not have spaces between the words or any other marks of punctuation, you might just be in danger of reading the word of God in a heretical way. I'm going to try and you know, read the Latin and pick it apart a little bit in English, but it's certainly easier if one sees it, but I hope it will work. So Augustine gives an example and says, in the very first beginning of Genesis, I'm going to read it with a German accent in Latin. In principio erat verbum, et verbum erat apud Deum, et Deus erat verbum, hoc erat in principio apud Deum. So in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word that was in the beginning with God. So sorry, that's my very spontaneous Latin translation of what I see in front of me. But, you know, if you pause in the wrong ways, you can say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was. The Word was in the beginning with God. So, but it, of course, official doctrine is, and God was the Word. So, so it's rather crucial for Trinitarian Christianity that God is the Word as well, and not the Word something else, I suppose. So that was the example that Augustine mentioned in terms of punctuation, especially the spaces between words, as being really critical in passing on dogma, or not dogma in a like super bad way, but received understanding, I suppose, or doctrine, maybe. And Augustine actually also gives, I think, a classical example. So that was not something like an example by Virgil. So that's not really something that's just for Christianity. And there's so many other examples. So yes, at the beginning, in the beginning, there was the Word, and the punctuation was there in order to make sense. And there's some examples also now where punctuation is crucial if you want to really, really, really make sure that people understand you. Especially if there's a sentence that is decontextualized. Eric from New York sent me an example, and incidentally, that kind of example always throws me off because I keep forgetting the difference between restrictive and non-restrictive sentences. But he very kindly gave me an example, which is very up to date. So he said, Republicans, comma, who are Trump supporters, comma, should be defeated. And then the other example, Republicans who are Trump supporters should be defeated. So the second example, without commas, is restrictive. applying to some, not all, Republicans, whereas the first sentence, with commas, defines Republicans in general, applying to all, not just some. I leave it at that, because I don't know, I totally get it, but I just always keep forgetting the difference. But I think it becomes clear, you know, you have Republicans, who are also Trump supporters, should be defeated. And then Republicans, namely only those who are Trump supporters, should be defeated. And then you have Republicans from the Lincoln Project, for example, who are okay. So sometimes, yes, we need a comma. We need punctuation to be more specific. But actually, those instances are rare enough. So I'm sure if we would see that sentence that I just mentioned in a context where somebody talks about the Lincoln Project or talks about Republicans and Democrats in general, we would be able to make sense. Very often, just that fun, that punning, that ambiguity is created by decontextualizing. And you know, thinking about punctuation and rules in general has not stopped in the 18th century. And I think that's really important, and we don't really realize, and we probably don't talk about it enough in just the general discourse and in the public, that there's no such thing as things having to stay. If people realize, you know, they think apostrophes are just, you know, cumbersome, then, you know, maybe we shouldn't be using them. For example, somebody like George Bernard Shaw, who was a great proponent of spelling reformation based on phonetic principles, said that the apostrophe is mostly redundant. And when he wants to signal colloquial dialogue, he writes can't and he's and this kind of stuff without an apostrophe. He called them bacilli, peppering the pages or something like that. Some people call them ugly. Some people call them all sorts of things. I think they're lovely and beautiful, but I can see where they're coming from. They say it's cluttered, and you know, nobody misreads can't if you have a whole dialogue on the page. There's no word that's right, can't, like, okay, can't, the jargon is another word, but if you encounter the word C-A-N-T in a context and it means, and it says he can't come, you will not think that, oh, can't, that's, you know, the synonym for jargon. However, Shaw did make a difference for a word like I'm and it's and he'll, because otherwise it would become hell. But, you know, I don't know. Again, context. I think one ought to be able to find things out via context. But that does mean it takes a little bit more time. And I guess, again, if we want to be swift and probably effective and just passing on the semantic meaning or something like that, yeah, probably we should be using apostrophes or punctuation in general. But, you know, if we write something and somebody takes time over it, or if it's a piece of literature or something, well, why not? Why not use what works and not use what doesn't work? Now I want to just mention some examples from literature where I think ambiguity is actually key and is actually what's wanted and is actually created through punctuation, or rather the lack thereof. There's this very famous end section of Ulysses where Molly, the wife of Bloom, who, you know, who's sort of the main character, if there is a main character of Ulysses. So his wife Molly, she has a monologue, like an interior monologue. And that is just one stream of consciousness without punctuation, without marks rather, because I think it's in lowercase, all of it. And there are spaces between the words. So that is already quite a lot of punctuation, I think, you know, margins and whatever. But it's upside down, so people have to do something to the page in the book a little bit. But there's just this, like, you know, continuous stream of her thoughts, and there's no full stop, there's no comma, whatever. And there are some moments of ambiguity where you're not entirely sure, is she finished here now, and does this, what she just say, pertain to what she said before, or does it also pertain to what she's saying after, and does she continue, and so on. And that ambiguity is so fruitful and so exciting. I don't know if I want to read a whole book like that, because there are books like that, but it's very attractive, you know, at points, at strategic points, I think. There is a literary, like a stylistic phenomenon called apokoinu that I love, and that is exactly, that exploits ambiguity between the juncture of something, two elements of something. So that means if the, through lack of punctuation very often, you have the end of a sentence or phrase or whatever it is, that is the beginning of the next one, and it kind of straddles both. So an example from Shakespeare that is just so beautiful, I should have looked it up again, should have done my homework, but I kind of know it by heart, but not the end, so I'm just going to improvise and then tell you where I edit. The example from Shakespeare that I want to mention in terms of the apokoinu is from Lucrece, The Rape of Lucrece, and that is one of his poems, his narrative poems about a Roman woman, the wife of one Collatine, who was a soldier and who was in a camp a couple of kilometers outside of Rome. And he was some other soldiers in the camp, like high-level soldiers. He talks about his wife and how beautiful she is and how chaste and how she's waiting for him at home and whatever. And by talking like that, he inflames the lust of one Tarquin, who is the son of the king of Rome at the time, if I remember right. And then he rides, this Tarquin rides the whole night through to Rome, and he kind of sneaks his way into the house through pretending to, you know, to be very polite. And of course, Lucrece is like, okay, this is my husband's colleague or whatever, and I better let him in, although it's the middle of the night and whatever. But then he actually rapes her. And she is in such despair because she feels violated, obviously, and she feels shame and guilty and filthy and whatever, horrible thing. And so she's trying to express her grief somehow. She's looking for words, she's looking for whatever kind of something to express her grief. And she comes across, she's very eloquent in trying to express grief and saying, oh, I'm failing. But obviously she's very eloquent in failing. And then she comes across an image, a picture, a painting of Troy, the fall of Troy. And she sees Hecuba, the mother of Troilus and of Hector and the Greek, Trojan princes. So like another wife, another mother figure. And Hecuba is wailing because Troy is burning down and her sons are all dead and her husband is dead and has been, you know, killed by the son of Achilles, doesn't matter. And so she says, and Lucrece, or Shakespeare rather, says, Lucrece, despairing Hecuba did see, something like that. Then she despairing Hecuba did see. And then she feels like, oh my God, here's Hecuba, and finally here's someone, anybody, any figure from mythology, anyone who feels what I feel. And she uses Hecuba and she sort of tells the story of Hecuba, what she sees, and it helps her express her grief. Then she despairing Hecuba did see. And that despairing, that's the hinge, that's the apokoinu, because there is no punctuation mark that says then she, comma, despairing, comma, Hecuba did see, or then she, comma, despairing Hecuba did see. In any case, the despairing pertains both to both to Lucrece back and forward to Hecuba. So Lucrece is despairing and Hecuba is despairing. They both are, and the despair and the active, the present participle, the action, despairing is what links them together. So that's ambiguity, right? Because you can't tell, well, who is despairing here from them? But they both are, and so that's the link between them, and that's just so gorgeous. That's so beautiful. And if there had been punctuation, well, imagine what we would have lost. So, an example of, well, what is ambiguity? I guess ambiguity is holding together two things that might be contradictory, or that might be a bit mutually exclusive, or that might rub against each other, or that might be similar, but still there's some kind of difference. And that holding together, that suspense, is restless, and you wrestle with it, but that's just so interesting, and that's what your brain really wants, right? So I think ambiguity and punctuation that is ambiguous, or that's not there, and thereby creating ambiguity, helps us become more tolerant and realize that you can turn things upside down and inside out from one moment to the next, right? Like an optical illusion. And I think it helps us be more generous and realize that life is just not clear cut. And I think ambiguity is fuzzy, and we have to just constantly make an effort to understand that we'll probably always be just out of our reach, out of our mental grasp, which is exactly how it should be. And because I think ambiguity is, things that are ambiguous are both and. And that makes nervous. And that's a good kind of nervousness, because it makes us critical and makes us ask. It makes us zoom out and observe and see and pay attention and take time. And this, I think this is sort of a refrain that I come back to time and again. That punctuation is supposed to make things faster. And it does. But it also very much slows us down and wants us to look. Again, ambiguous, you know. It makes things faster and it slows us down. So, to come back to the initial question, is understanding not the primary objective of communication? I would say, to that rhetorical question, I would say, well, it's not a rhetorical question, because I would say yes and no. Is punctuation a courtesy to your readers designed to help them understand a story? Yes and no, but more no, to be perfectly honest. Because I don't want to be treated courteously as a reader. If I really read good literature, I want to be challenged, but in a sort of a safe and good measure. I don't want to be overwhelmed with having to sort of plow through an unpunctuated book of 200 pages or something. But in a strategically placed, a short story, a section, whatever it is, you know, the final line of a poem, that's what I want. Of course it is. Be a bit discourteous and rude to me in your punctuation. Give me pushing punctuation. I think I can take it, and I think I want to take it. And so, that's just sort of my thoughts on against rules, I guess, and for ambiguity. I hope that was interesting, or maybe provocative, and I'll be very happy to hear any kind of feedback, especially challenging feedback, and that actually argues for rules. Until then, all the best, stay safe, and see you, hear you, listen to you, talk to you again soon.